Open your Bibles with me, if you would, to the book of Ezra. We're coming into a period of history when we get into Ezra and the other prophets. We're coming into a period of history that's covered by many different books of the Bible, many different prophets. Ezra and then Nehemiah just kind of continues the story on after Ezra. Something that I know that I can sometimes forget and fail to put into chronological order the prophets. I mean, if you really got down to it, Isaiah and Jeremiah are prophets that lived prior to the time that we're studying right now in Ezra. And that will be relevant tonight as we look at this, because Isaiah prophesied a man's name 140 or so years before the man was born. And Jeremiah prophesied some things that would take place as far as the Persian Empire taking and ruling over the Babylonian Empire. And of course, what these prophets said, God brought to pass. And it is such a reminder, Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it whithersoever he will. And that's not just a godly king, that is any king. The Gentile king of Persia, we'll see tonight, Cyrus, was moved upon by the Spirit of God to let the children of Israel go back home. We'll talk more about that, but it is amazing. We talk about providence. Providence is God working out all the details to bring his plan to the desired end. Sister Janet had to get to somewhere around Milwaukee, somewhere over there in Wisconsin. And they had to go through many things, different steps of details. And they actually took the ferry across Lake Michigan, but they planned to do this, and they planned to do that, and they planned to be at this point, at this time, and this point, at this time. And now to do that, they had to make sure the car had gas, that the tires had nitrogen, that they were able to get there on time, and everything had to fall into place. As it relates to God, he's bringing all the details of everything he's working on together perfectly, and we call that divine providence. He is directing in every detail. And even the king's heart, and the king is the emphasized point here, the most influential, the most powerful, even his heart is in the hand of God. And he can turn that heart. He wants the king to go that way. He'll make the king to go that way. And the king is operating under his own decision-making ability, but God works the details within him that he says, this makes the most sense to go that way, and that's the way I want to go. He doesn't take folks kicking and screaming against their will. He makes them willing to go. So we're at a point in time now, as we get to the book of Ezra, that will begin to have, when you're looking at the scriptures in a chronological order, when we get up to Isaiah and Jeremiah, you'll end up looking back and reviewing some things chronologically. They're set prior to our time frame right now. But Ezra is the book that tells us of how God worked it out so that the children of Israel could go back home after their time in exile. Now, I try to give general dates because you read four or five different authors and you're going to get three or four different opinions on dates and times and these things. So I'll give you general ideas that, and sometimes I kind of took two or three or four authors that seem to be the most credible and kind of average them out between them, and then where there's specific timelines between them, like 70 years of captivity, well then there's 70 years of captivity. Ezra's written, again, like the Chronicles, it's a compilation. It seems as though Ezra, who is a priest and scribe, compiled these notes and put them. There's some royal correspondence within the book of Ezra. Kings writing to kings is what I mean. And there's the reviewing of how God worked so that the children of Israel would be freed from the Babylonian captivity. Now, it's parallel in 1 and 2 Chronicles. Ezra there was reestablishing their godly heritage. There's your lineage. Your children of God. Start acting like it. Let's go back to Jerusalem and live there like it. Now, most of these folks didn't return home in the sense that they once lived there, they were yanked out, and then they went back. Many of these folks that went back, this is the first time they ever saw Jerusalem. This is the first time they were ever there. Because a couple of generations had passed, and there may have been those, I do not know, that were very, very young, and then got to go back when they're very old. But most of them, when they walked back into Jerusalem, seems to me, it's the first time they saw the place. So they're getting reestablished in every aspect and detail of who they are and their godly heritage. That's what Chronicles tells us, is those reconnections, those reestablishments. Ezra details how God worked it out. Now, I read to you back, and you can take notes on this, 2 Kings 19, 32 through 36. 2 Kings 19, 32 through 36. Assyria wanted to take Judah. Remember that? Assyria had already taken Israel. Now remember, we're talking about the divided kingdom. And Israel represents the 10 northern tribes. Okay? Judah represents the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And Judah had already, Assyria had already taken Israel and conquered them, hauled them off into captivity. About 130 years later, Judah fell to his, they dismantled as a country, as a nation, they fell, but not to Assyria. Assyria wanted them, but 2 Kings 19, 32 through 36 says that God stopped Assyria and turned them back. God said, no, they're going into bondage, but not you guys. Go to 2 Kings 20, 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 14. And we'll read where God indicates that it will be a Babylonian captivity. 2 Kings 20, 14. Then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah, and said unto him, what said these men? And from whence come they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, they are come from a far country, even from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in thy house? And Hezekiah answered, all the things that are in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. And Isaiah said unto Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. So there's an indication here of what God is doing. God told Assyria, no, you can't have them. They're not yours. Now Babylon, that's a different story. And under Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon conquered them, conquered Judah, took them into captivity, and there they remained for 70 years. Now, there's even some debate on that, but seemingly 70 years. Now, they're in captivity, and while they're in captivity, Persia conquers Babylon. And let's look at 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36. And we'll look at verses 18 through 21. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of the princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God, and brake down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the places thereof with fire. I'm in 2 Chronicles 36, just finishing up verse 19. They burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the godly vessels thereof. And them that escaped from the sword carried he to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign, get this, until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. While they were in Babylonian captivity, while the children of Judah were in Babylonian captivity, Persia defeats Babylon. And King Cyrus is the king of Persia. And now we'll meet him on the next page. Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Notice how this is written. The Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Now who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. That little phrase right there tells you something. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. Why did the king of Persia want the children of Israel? I'm going back to them as a nation, not the 10 northern tribes, but them as a nation. Why did the king of Persia want them to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their place of worship? Well, I know technically why, that the Spirit of the Lord moved King Cyrus to want that to happen. But God doesn't work in a vacuum. What did he do that moved King Cyrus to want them to go back to Jerusalem? What made it a practical, feasible, good thing in the eyes of King Cyrus? There's two theories, and I believe, well, I've actually only read the one. Militarily, you look at a map, and it would put a buffer zone militarily between Persia and, I believe it was Egypt. Yeah. And militarily, maybe that's the case. I actually don't think that was King Cyrus's motivation. I think the hint is in the latter part of verse 3. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. King Cyrus, a heathen king, would have probably, as most heathen kings, have recognized many gods the river god, moon god, the sun god, you know, the wooden pew god, the table god. It didn't matter. I believe that what King Cyrus's motivation was is this. There's another god out there that I could maybe please by letting his people go back to their homeland, and then he would then be pleased with me. King Cyrus is in this for himself and his kingdom. That's my opinion. It would seem to me that from a practical standpoint, that's what King Cyrus is doing. Now, the bottom line is, God moved upon his heart and told him, hey, who's from Jerusalem? Go. I release you. Now, they're still under the rule of Persia. They're still a territory under the rule of Persia. They're not a self-standing nation. Never a king again. The king is King Jesus, but not a human king after the time of the kings. And so they're under Persian rule. But King Cyrus says, okay, guys, go on back. And just shy of 50,000, go on back. You can read that number in Ezra chapter 2, basically. You have to read all of chapter 2 and get a calculator and add it up. It's just shy of 50,000 people. Now, as God was moving upon King Ezra, King Cyrus, he's also moving upon his people. God doesn't work in a vacuum. He's moving and he's working all the details together as it pleases him. And even verse 4, let's see, no, verse 5 of chapter 1. Then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites with all them whose spirit God had raised to go up to build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. Not only did God work on King Cyrus, but he then begins to work on the priests. Word gets around that King Cyrus is letting them go, and the priests say, yeah! Let's go back and build the house of God. Let's rebuild the temple. We read in your hearing tonight how that they destroyed it. And so God begins to move. And the latter part of chapter 1 there, even King Cyrus makes a decree, not only the people and about 50,000 go. Now there's more than one wave of people that go back to Jerusalem. The first wave that we'll read about now is about 50,000 or so people were led under Zerubbabel. And the King Cyrus says, and not only the people, but take the things of the temple, the valuable things, the tools for worship, take those things with you and go ahead and make your way back to your homeland. I just happen to think that it's done out of a motivation of maybe there's one more God out there that I didn't know about that I can please. I don't know that, but that's my opinion. So they go on, and chapter 2 tells us, now these are the children of the province that went up out of the captivity of those which had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away unto Babylon, and came again unto Jerusalem and Judah, everyone to his own city, which came with Zerubbabel. And so Zerubbabel is the leader of this first wave that goes back into Jerusalem. I mean, he's the leader of about 50,000. And in chapter 2, we have a list of groups of people, and you have to do a bunch of addition. Comes up to specifically 49,897. And they're on their way back. Remember, it's a remnant. As far as a nation goes, it's not a big number. But it's a remnant to preserve the line on up to Christ. And God is fulfilling his promise that way. There will be another wave led by Ezra himself, but only of a couple thousand. And then Nehemiah will lead the third wave, and Lord willing, we'll read about that next week as Nehemiah leads the third wave back. And that, as I understand, it's about 80 years after Zerubbabel. And Nehemiah, of course, the famous wall builder around Jerusalem. And that's the third wave that Lord willing, Nehemiah will tell us about next week. So in chapter 2, we have the who. Who's going back? In chapter 3, we have the reestablishing of the altar and the temple. Chapter 3, and when the seventh month was come and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren, the priest, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and builded the altar of God and of Israel, of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar upon his bases, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries. And they offered burnt offerings thereon unto the Lord, even burnt offerings morning and evening. Now, we have in there a couple of little nuggets that really tell us a lot, that they were doing this as it was written in the law of Moses in verse 2. They're going back to the writings of Moses, and they're reestablishing proper worship, doing it God's way. Another thing it tells us that they were constantly under pressure of opposition because of the people of those countries. It says there in verse 3. So there's a lot of opposition to the building of God's house. Now, the Persian king Cyrus had told them to go and gave them what they needed to go and gave them the tools of the temple back to them. But there was still opposition, and you got to understand, it's not like you pick up the telephone and call King Cyrus and say, hey, you've got some guys over here that are opposing me or us, and we need to take care of this. Things of that nature move very slowly, and this opposition grew, and it really put a monkey wrench into the building of the temple. They were working on it, and at one point they even... The building of the temple even ceased. Ezra chapter 4, verses 23 and 24 tell us that. Ezra 4, 23 and 24. Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews, and made them cease by force and power. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So Cyrus is now off the scene, and this is about a 15-year gap, it seems like, where the building had ceased, and Cyrus is no longer the king of Persia, but Darius is. And now Darius gets wind of this and says, we told you guys to build it, build it. And Darius makes a decree, no one stops them. And when the king of Persia makes a decree like that, then things get done. And the opposition was forced to dial it back. Darius makes a decree, and Ezra chapter 6 begins. It's a lengthy passage, but he tells us in Ezra chapter 6, then Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasures were laid up in Babylon. And there was found at Achmithea, in the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, and therein was a record thus written. So Darius says, let's find out what Cyrus said. let's go back and get this thing right. And this is what was written. In the first year of Cyrus, the king, the same Cyrus, the king, made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be builded in the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations thereof be strongly laid, the height thereof 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 70 cubits, with 3 rows of great stones and a row of new timber. Let the expenses be given out of the king's house. Not only go build it, but we'll finance it. And also let the golden and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took forth out of the temple, which was at Jerusalem and brought up to Babylon, be restored. Give them all their stuff back, like King Cyrus said. And brought again unto the temple, which is at Jerusalem, every one to his place, and placed them in the house of God. And so, in verse 8, he says, moreover, okay, he's going to go on from where Cyrus was. Moreover, I make a decree that you shall do to the elders of the Jews for the building of this house, a house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, forthwith expenses be given unto these men, that they be not hindered. And so, not only does this Darius reestablish King Cyrus's command, but he even goes a little further to help them get this done. Verses 13 through 19 record the temple being completed. And let's just, for brevity's sake, read verse 19. And the children of captivity kept the Passover upon the 14th day of the first month. They got the house of God rebuilt, and they kept the Passover. So they're back in their homeland, and Chronicles tells us of their godly heritage. Ezra tells us how that God moved upon now King Cyrus and King Darius, how that God moved upon the hearts of the priests. And in the meantime, you have this period of time where things have slowed a little bit and things aren't going along the way that they should have been going along, about an 80-year chunk of time that between the first wave under Zerubbabel and the second wave under Ezra. And it would seem like the situation was this, where that they began to get a little spiritually cool. Ezra kind of hears about that and says to the king, I got to get over there, and I've got to lead them out of this coldness, and I got to get them going back in the right direction. King says, okay. Ezra chapter 8 tells us this story, how that Ezra leads the second wave. And we have in Ezra chapter 8 about 2,000 go back with Ezra. Remember, Ezra, a priest and a scribe, well-versed in the scriptures, and a priest of the Levitical order. And so now 80 years have passed since King Cyrus made the original decree. We're up in the low 500s to mid 400 years before Christ. We've really made our way chronologically a long way towards Christ, but through the prophets of the scriptures and the balance of the Old Testament, not counting the poetical books like Psalms so much, but we'll be given information about this basic time frame from the various different prophets and their viewpoint. In Ezra chapter 9, Ezra gets back on the scene after leading his couple of thousand over there. Ezra begins to deal with something very touchy. Chapter 9, chapter 10, the same thing that had caused them problems over and over, the same thing that had made God so angry with Solomon, the marrying of God's children with ungodly spouses. And Ezra gets this thing, and he takes the bull by the horns, Ezra chapter 9, Ezra chapter 10, you can read it, and he calls for a reestablishment of biblical unions, even to the place where he calls for the dissolving of those unions that are not biblical. Now, think about it from the viewpoint of Ezra. He knows what happened when Solomon's heart was led astray by his many wives, his many, the Bible says, strange wives or Gentile, heathen wives. And so Ezra is trying to stop the tide from going that way and get it to be going in the right direction. And so he's calling for a biblical reestablishment of God's people marrying God's people and not letting that opportunity for the strange gods to get in the mix. He would have that vantage point of seeing from the scriptures as a scribe, knowing the scriptures very well, he would have the vantage point of seeing that Deuteronomy 7 is so strong that you do not take their daughters unto your sons, and you do not give your daughters unto their sons, talking about heathen nations. He would have known well of Solomon and his problems because of this. And so when he gets onto the scene in Jerusalem in Ezra 9 and 10, he says, no, wait, stop, guys. We're going to be right back where we were, if you don't quit this. And so he calls for that reestablishment of biblical marriages. So that is an overview of the book of Ezra. Lord willing, next Wednesday, the book of Nehemiah is probably a little better known for whatever reason. Seems to be preached from more often than maybe Ezra. But it's this third wave that will head into Jerusalem, led by Nehemiah. And again, we will be reading of how that God moves upon the hearts of kings, Gentile kings, to provide them what they need to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. And one of the two biggest characters, Sanballat and Tobiah, I think are their names. And they're opposing Nehemiah every step of the way. And Nehemiah just keeps on going. He said, doing a great work. Children of Israel are doing a great work. And it's a very instructive book, and Lord willing, we'll look at it next week. But it'll represent a third wave of people headed back to Jerusalem to reestablish proper worship, to reestablish the house of God and the proper things that are going on there. And in the process, reestablishing the whole nation as they once again find their godly heritage. And the prophets of God cry out against whatever sin they're stumbling in at that time. And so as we read through the prophets, we'll go back and reflect on different stages and that particular prophet crying out, stop, don't do this, don't go that way, go that way. And so we'll try to put all that in perspective as we go through it. All right. We'll be dismissed in prayer.